Welcome back to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Barb McQuaid, Kimberly Atkins-Store, and me, Joyce Vance. It is almost May, and that means the Hashtag Sisters-in-Law live tour. I can't wait to see my sisters in person. We'll be in Chicago on May 2nd, which is only about a week away. Holy moly. We'll be in Detroit on May 9 and Boston on May 30. So go and grab yourself some tickets if you haven't already. You can find them at politicon.com/tour. But before we get started with the show, I have something I need to discuss with my sisters. Y'all, I'm up in Washington today this weekend for the White House Correspondents' Dinner, which is very exciting. But I do not do black tie very often, and I don't do it particularly well if the truth has to be told. But this year I've got to do it twice in a row because we won a Webby Award. So we'll all be together in New York to accept it next month. Is everybody excited?
I'm thrilled, but I want to know, is everyone, you know, are you all going to really wear long dresses and sequins? Because during COVID, I kind of gave away all of my black tie things, and I'm kind of excited. I wish that Kim was making us dresses because she's so good at it. But since she's not going to have time, I'm sort of excited about going to look for a new dress. But I want to make sure that you're all doing the same thing. Are you?
Well, the good news is we don't have to all do the same thing. The ceremony is in New York. It's at Cipriani's downtown. And one thing that I loved about New York is that you can really do what you want. You can look your own personal best, whether it's, you know, black tie or not. That's one of the things I miss most about living there. But I have the benefit that I have a closet full of stuff that I've made over the years. And I've not worn any of my gowns to New York. So anything that I wear will be new. I'll be wearing something that has made a past appearance at a White House Correspondents' Dinner choice. But, you know, it'll be new to New York. What about you,
Barb?
There
you go. And new to us. I can't wait to see you, Kim.
So let me say this. I'm very grateful to have won a Webby Award with all, and very proud to have won a Webby Award with all of you. But the idea of wearing a gown to an event in New York, man, you know, I don't have a closet full of gowns, unlike Kim. And
but Barb, you can get one with pockets.
Oh, a gown. All right, now you're talking. A gown. You know, I've got business suits and blazers, and I've got, you know, I'm hanging out on the weekend in my blue jeans and workout attire, and that's about it, and nothing
but listen,
in between.
Elizabeth Warren wears a blazer and pants to every event, including White House Correspondents' Dinners. Like, that's her uniform. Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, that'd
be good
company.
Enough for her, it's
okay.
Good.
Okay, now you're talking. That too. What's your idea, Jill?
I have a great idea for you, Barb. I actually do have a tuxedo. And
ooh,
you could wear a tuxedo, and that has pockets, both in the jacket and the pants.
I am a little intrigued by the pockets. But yeah,
I might be borrowing that, Jill.
Okay, you're welcome to it.
All right, I'll get poking around in the internet and see what I can come up with. You know what I'm reminded of? I'm gonna have to I saw it in the window and I couldn't resist. You guys ever see that Carol Burnett episode where she spoofs Gone with the Wind and she comes down with the gown with the curtains and the curtain?
Yes.
Rack? I'm gonna show up looking like that.
Yes.
Yes.
That's hilarious.
You will be the star of the show, Barb.
On Thursday, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in the Trump federal election interference case. They were, of course, hearing the appeal of lower court decisions rejecting Donald Trump's assertion that a president is absolutely immune from criminal prosecution. You know, before I start with questions, I did want to just highlight my favorite tweet of the day. It came from Marcy Wheeler, who said, what if, hypothetical for Justice Alito, what if a female president had an abortion in Idaho, would she be immune from prosecution? I thought that was good. But Joyce, I want to start with you. You were actually at the court, right? You were outside there in that space called the Senate Swamp between the Capitol and the Supreme Court. You were there. So set the scene for us. Like anything, you know, interesting observations of color? Were there protesters? What was that
like? I mean, you know, it's always interesting to be at the Supreme Court for argument day. I'm a member of the Supreme Court bar. I've been for a number of cases, including a couple while we were U.S. attorneys. Barb, I was there for U.S. versus Arizona, the immigration case, and also for one of the voting rights cases, the redistricting case later in that time period. It's a different court today, quite frankly. There have always been protesters. It's a time-honored tradition at the court, but the tone was a little bit nastier this week. We had someone behind us. I was with Andrea Mitchell, as you said, across the street in the Senate Swamp doing some on-air commentary. We had a guy walking behind us just for hours yelling, fake news, you know, you're fake news, and other somewhat more disturbing sort of politically motivated protests. So that was sort of the tone outside of the court.
Yeah. And then how about your top line takeaway? You know, we heard the arguments and I want to get into detail, but, you know, just if there's one thing that maybe you would say summarizes what you think happened yesterday, what would that top line takeaway be?
Yeah. So I know a lot of people were disturbed by the turn that the argument took, especially because no one anticipated that Trump could walk away with absolute immunity. That would be just a ridiculous result. I think sometimes we have to just hold in abeyance our anxiety following an argument and wait to see what the opinion holds. The opinion is not the argument. It seems clear this case will turn on Chief Justice Roberts' position on the case. He was uncharacteristically quiet during the argument. And while the three liberal justices clearly believe Donald Trump needs to be reined in and presidents should have accountability lest the Oval Office become crime central, in Justice Jackson's words, the conservative wing of the court, you know, the conservative justices seemed far more concerned about this theoretical possibility of an unethical prosecutor who would be unchecked by layers of court processes. So it's going to come down to Barrett and Roberts. She seemed inclined to look for a compromise that would let trial go forward. I hope she can pull him into her lane.
Yeah, Kim, what were your takeaways? I was a little surprised, but pleased to hear what Justice Barrett had to say. What was your top line takeaway from the argument?
Well, yes. Yeah. So I agree with you that Justice Barrett did not seem inclined to give the whole store to Trump in this. And in her questioning, she expressed more than a little critique of Donald Trump's arguments, to say the least. But one thing that really concerned me, I thought the worst case scenario would be that the Supreme Court would take their time and kind of run out the clock a bit before they remanded this case back down to the trial level, maybe with some questions that Judge Chutkan would need to clarify through a hearing, and then it would get going, but it wouldn't get going in time for the election. I now think that there is a worst case scenario, and I think what's coming back is the discussion we had previously about the weirdness of the question.
Absolutely.
Yes, yes, will remember that when there is a question presented, it's what the Supreme Court is the question that the Supreme Court decides they're going to answer. And in that, there was this weird, like, alleged official acts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
When we pointed out, Jack Smith is not alleging that anything was an official act. He is alleging that things were crimes, right? So only Trump is alleging that these things are official acts and that they would somehow, based on no constitutional or legal framework, get immunity if they're official acts. And so much of the arguments, including some of the questions from Justice Barrett, even though they seem to clarify that, you know, criming is not an official act, was focused on this issue in a way that I think they can take their sweet time, A, in issuing an opinion at the end of the term, at the end of June, about what might and what might not constitute an official act, and then remand it down to Chutkan. And so that scares me because where are they going to draw these lines? And as you pointed out, we know clearly where four justices are. We know the three that were never in play, Alito, Thomas, and Gorsuch. Kavanaugh was shockingly to me in Trump's realm that I think he was expressing all this concern about, but how can a president do their job if they're going to be... By not criming, Justice Kavanaugh, by not criming. But it seems that Amy Coney Barrett was a little skeptical of this, and we don't know where Chief Justice John Roberts is. If he can be convinced that there's a line to be drawn somewhere, and that would be an unbelievable win for Donald Trump and an unbelievable loss for those who love democracy, in my opinion.
And Kim, can I just say, I mean, I guess this is therapy for all of us in some sense right now, because it was such a weird argument. But were you stunned that Kavanaugh jumped in? He was the sponsor for this argument that you can't prosecute a president unless the statute explicitly says that you can prosecute a president. Gorsuch jumped in. He used one example of this obscure election statute, you know, that specifically says a president can be prosecuted, to say, well, Congress clearly doesn't mean it in anything else. And that's de facto absolute immunity, right? If every statute, like if it has to say conspiracy and you can prosecute the president, he has de facto immunity. That view is so frightening.
It is so frightening. And who knows how far he will go with that. And I think that's one of the reasons I posted on Threads, like, why is Alito like having a sermon right now? Because he knows his view is so far for the right. Does he actually think, who is he doing this for? Does he think he can get more people on his side, a la Dobbs, for a much more broad reading of immunity? And how do we all have to rely on Chief Justice John Roberts for the future of our democracy? I think that's a strange proposition. That's why I posted, like, this went worse than I was expecting. And people were like, no, I think you're wrong. And I'm like, all right, we'll see.
Jill, what was your top line takeaway?
So it's always hard being after the last person to weigh in on this. But despite that, I do have at least three things I want to point out. And so I'm going to talk really fast because you asked for only one. One is, the most incredible thing to me was Sauer, who is Trump's lawyer, admitting that there are private acts alleged, and that they are not covered by immunity. That seems like there's definitely a trial that can go forward, at least on those allegations. Then I was shocked by the comments from the conservative justices saying, well, we're writing a rule for the ages, a rule for the future. And that sort of goes to what Kim said. And that's very disturbing, because their job is to determine the facts and the law in a particular controversy that is before them, not to predict and write rules for governing. So that was very, very bad. And then I was very pleased with Dreeben, who is the representative for the prosecution, arguing that accountability under the criminal law is the best way to keep things going. And that is the best answer to all these arguments about, oh, we're so worried about crazy prosecutors are going to go crazy. First of all, I'm more concerned that a crazy president, not held accountable, will continue to destroy our democracy. And so I thought that Dreeben's comment about separations of powers and about holding someone accountable under the criminal laws was a really good point.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I think that where we go from here really is going to depend a lot on Chief Justice John Roberts, isn't it? I mean, I think we know where some of these justices stand. Probably no surprise. Barrett seems like she's inclined to vote in some way with the special counsel, I thought. But Roberts was really interesting to me, because on the one hand, he seemed very unhappy with the decision of the Court of Appeals below. He kept saying, their decision is a tautology. It's a tautology. They say because the president has been prosecuted, he can be prosecuted. I actually had to look up tautology. I didn't know what that word meant. Yeah, I'll confess. Yeah, I didn't know what it meant. It is true. I did not know what the word meant. I looked it up.
I did too.
I know. You're like, this is a tauntaun. And I thought, thank God I'm not arguing because I would have
no way.
Asked, I'm sorry, what's a tauntaun?
That is not true.
So he kept saying it again and again. I mean, I know the concept because, I was teaching to my appellate, my criminal procedure students recently at the plain error standard. A plain error is an error that is plain. I mean, that is a tautology, right? Now I have a word for it. But his point seemed to be that he was unhappy with the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals because rather than analyzing the facts of the case, they just said a president can be prosecuted because a president has been prosecuted, and he didn't like that. So that worries me that he seems to think that maybe this is an open question or a closed question. But then he also said what I thought was very interesting about how a president can be charged with bribery for doing an official act like appointing an ambassador. And when John Sauer, the lawyer for Donald Trump, said something like, well, the appointment of the president can't be, or the appointment of the ambassador can't be, only the bribery can. He said, but that's like a one-legged stool. You know, you got to be able to show the quid pro quo. And so, of course, you have to come back to official act. So I'm not quite sure where he comes down on this. And so it doesn't seem like he's on the fast track, though, which is, I think, ultimately, we will find that this case is not protected by presidential immunity. I'm worried that we might just not find that out until like 2026, if we get there. Well, let me move on from there. Jill raised this point, Joyce, and let me ask you about this, where Justice Kavanaugh, and I think it was Justice Gorsuch, said more than once, I'm not worried about this case. It's the future I'm worried about. And as Jill said, I mean, isn't the whole point of deciding a case or controversy the idea that you decide only this case that is in front of you and you decide it on the narrowest grounds possible because you can't predict what future cases might come down the road? And so you're supposed to decide it as narrowly as possible. What are they doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's first principles, right? You only decide the controversy in front of you, not other theoretical issues. And the government argued this in their brief. They told the court that while there might be some small slice of immunity for some official conduct, you know, it's important to understand the playing field, right? Everybody agrees, and Sauer concedes an oral argument, that there's no immunity for purely private issues. We're talking about official acts of a president. And so they say that while there might be some slice of immunity for official conduct by a president, you know, the government says, look, justices, you don't need to decide what the scope of that is here. All you need to do is say that for what Donald Trump did trying to steal an election, there's no immunity, and send the case back to Judge Chutkan to get ready for trial. And this is a time-honored principle. Don't decide future cases, just the one in front of you. But Kim, I think you mentioned this stems back to the question that the court drafted, the issue it wanted to hear. We've been concerned about that all along, and now it seems clear that they've abandoned first principles.
Yeah, and it just makes me wonder, why are they doing that? Is it for purposes of delay, or is it, what would motivate them?
Listen, I'm the columnist here, so I will surmise, because I've already written this. I don't know, but is it because you have two justices in their 70s who very much would like to retire when a Republican is in office? Is it very much because we have two justices who like to see more conservatives appointed to the federal judiciary? I mean, why are they doing any of the things that they're doing? That also is a question that was, a subject that was in my question about why Alito was going on and on and on in his soliloquy, knowing that he wasn't using oral arguments to help formulate his opinion. It's already set. But why? Who is he signaling? I don't trust this court any farther than I can throw it anymore.
Let me ask you, Kim, about, we've talked a little bit about these questions by Justice Amy Coney Barrett. Pretty interesting. You know, she almost sounded like a lawyer at a deposition when she's kind of trying to pin down John Sauer about these specific acts alleged in the indictment. Would you concede that, eliciting fake electors is a private act? Yes. And she got him to agree with, you know, maybe three or four different acts. And then later, Justice Kagan took up the list. She's like, let me pick up where Justice Barrett left off. Would you agree this is a private act? Would you agree that is a private act? He did object to a few of them, but it almost seemed like maybe the two of them together were trying to let's get concessions that these are all private acts, and then we can just go to trial. And then regardless of what, you know, Gorsuch and Kavanaugh think about deciding the case for the ages, go, you know, do whatever you want there. But we've got concessions that these are all private. So what do you think? You expressed maybe some concern about that. What do you think?
No, I think so. This is what I think is interesting about Amy Coney Barrett, because we don't know a ton about her. Like, really, all I knew is like she was a vote in favor of Dobbs, but she didn't issue any concurrence, anything. So like you did not hear her voice in that. And ever since then, I've been trying to figure her out, right? Both in this case and also in the case that we talked about last week about the January 6th rioters and that charge of conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding. She was asking very pointed questions. Last week, her questions were like, well, what would it be based? I'm paraphrasing, okay? Would it be an obstruction of an official proceeding? I don't know. If your last name rhymed with rump and you tried to get phony electors right. to sign a piece of paper, their documents, and blah, blah, like clearly making it clear that in her view, or she was at least trying to pin down that Donald Trump's charges were very different than the other January 6th defendants, right? Distinguishing that. I think that's what she was doing here too. That, okay, if we're going to play this official versus non-official act, let me just ask some questions about what's an official act and yeah. went through the list, hypothetically, air quotes, of exactly what is claimed in this case. And I think that that was smart. I think that Kagan is a smart lady and she picked up on that, because Kagan is always trying to look at where she can bridge some gap over to the conservative side. And she identified that and she seized on it. So I think that that was an important, very important part of the argument.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting too. Now, if they'd gotten him to concede to all of them, like, I think they, are we done here? Is this it? You know, but then what Kagan got going and he's maybe Sauer just caught on. He's like, nope, not that one. Not that one. Nope, not that one. Yeah. So there's some stuff left. Jill, I'm curious though, you know, I've heard this speculation. I think it's a super interesting idea. Could Jack Smith pare down his indictment to exclude anything that might even be arguably an official act, even if it's only evidence of the crimes charged, which is, of course, conspiracy to defraud the United States, conspiracy to obstruct an official proceeding, obstruction of an official proceeding, and violation of voting rights, or conspiracy to violate voting rights. I mean, none of those are official acts, but there are specific acts in support of those theories that I think probably do constitute official acts. You know, perhaps you might say his efforts regarding the Justice Department to use them in an effort to legitimize what he was doing. Do you think that Jack Smith could or should pare down the indictment and say, fine, I'm just going to abandon all of those things that are arguably official acts, and I'm going to focus on just the things that are clearly not, and let's go, baby, see at trial?
He certainly could. Whether he should is a different question. He may have to, depending on how the court rules. There is one advantage to this possibility that the court will seek delay by remanding for a hearing, because at the hearing, all of this evidence can be presented. And so while it's not going to go to verdict, it's not going to lead to a conviction or an acquittal or a hung jury, it would at least let the voters of America know what exactly was done. And I know that Donald Trump does not want that evidence before the public, before November. So it's sort of a lose for him if it is a remand, even though it's also a lose, we won't have a trial. So yes, it's, you know, and going back to what we were talking about, Sauer did eventually catch on after he admitted, oh yeah, that's a private act. That's definitely a private act. And I'm going, what? Did I just hear that right? And then the list went on and he kept admitting. When he got to the Department of Justice, it was like, well, you know, it's the president's responsibility to oversee and talk to the Department of Justice. So, you know, that's an official act. Of course, it's an official act for him to talk to them, not to ask them to commit crimes. So I don't see that. I could see that being remanded for Judge Chutkan to say, yeah, okay, let's have a hearing on this, whether this is official or private. But it would be an interesting way out of this to get all the things that were admitted in the oral argument were private, to be, okay, we'll go ahead with that, and then to use all this other evidence as part of proving the overall conspiracy, but not as a charged offense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think it's kind of interesting. Well, Joyce, one of the arguments Sauer made is one that I have long thought is just ridiculous. And do you think anybody bought us the one about a president must be impeached and be convicted before he can be criminally prosecuted? I mean, Justice Barrett, for one, seemed very skeptical. She asked why that's necessary. It's not in the text. You know, this is all that textualist cherry picking once again. If it's not in the text, then it's not a constitutional provision unless I want it to be. And she said, well, couldn't that apply to everybody, including the nine of us sitting here? And we know that's not the case. So do you think that argument has any merit and any life left after the oral argument?
No, I don't think it does. And I think it'll be a clear loss for Trump. Like you say, it's countertextual. I did not hear a single justice championing this flawed theory in oral argument. So I think it's dead. Let me just add on one thing to what Jill just said, because I think this prospect of a hearing is very interesting. I think Jack Smith has to be careful to not do anything before the court rules. That's unfortunate because it may mean sitting still for another couple of months. But he doesn't want to take action now and then have the Supreme Court rule in a way that either means he's bargained away, you know, he's bargained with himself and given up some ground he didn't need to, or that the court just goes an unpredictable way. I think we really are in a holding pattern until they rule.
Mm-hmm. You know, another one that really got my goat, Kim, let me ask you about this. Justice Alito, former U.S. attorney, almost always consistently rules in favor of the prosecution and against the defense when Michael Dreeben, the lawyer for Jack Smith's team, was talking about, we don't have to worry about presidents always constantly indicting their predecessors because there are all these layers of protection, right? There's the public authority defense. There is advice of counsel based on the best lawyers in the world at the White House and the Attorney General. And there is due process. There's a grand jury that has to find probable cause. And then Justice Alito has the audacity to say, yes, but can't a grand jury indict a ham sandwich? I was really flabbergasted by that. What was your reaction that a former prosecutor would say that? I mean, you know, you hear that from time to time by people who disparage the criminal justice system. But Justice Alito, I mean, what on earth was that all about? As you say, like, who is he talking to? Who is he performing for?
Why are you asking me to explain Sam Alito? Like, I have no explanation
I don't know.
For him.
I don't
Can
know.
Can we just all drink he a beer is, instead? I mean, I don't know how you
honestly,
understand what he's up to.
He is based on his speeches and what he wrote. Have you read Dobbs? Like, he is like a holy crusader who acts only on his own rules. He also had the audacity to say that, you know, questions about whether the president can assassinate his political enemies, which is, you know, an important question to ask, was an insult to SEAL Team 6.
Right. To SEAL Team 6.
Like, oh, SEAL what? Team 6, I'm not going to try to explain that, man. He explains himself. Res ipsa loquitur.
Oh, I love it when you talk Latin. Nice.
Wow,
nice.
Good one.
Again, we should define terms for our audience.
The thing
speaks
for itself,
means.
Right?
That's so good. I guess you're right. Justice Alito, res ipsa loquitur. Love it. Jill, let me ask you about this issue that Joyce mentioned earlier, where Justice Kavanaugh and Justice Gorsuch started talking about the clear statement rule when it comes to the statutes at issue. Can you explain what that is and why it might matter here? And this is an issue not even raised by any of the parties, and suddenly they're talking about this. This was the moment when my head was about to explode. Can you explain what that is and why it might matter here?
I definitely can. I will have to say that.
Well,
logical.
Played.
A yes, clear statement is a statement that is clear. It does. So no, but seriously, it is a rule for statutory construction. And you have to avoid having a construction that would cause problems. And in the context here, what they were talking about was this ridiculous idea that unless a criminal statute has a clause in it that says, and this applies to the president too, or this applies to the ex-president after he's out of office, that it doesn't apply to the president. That seems to me completely ridiculous. They pointed to one law that for some reason says that it applies to the president in addition to saying everything else. I can't imagine how it could apply here without it being completely over the top, absurd, and harmful to statutory construction. Of course, under our system of justice, no man, including the former president, is above the law. And he, like every other person, is subject to those laws. So to me, there's no clear statement
issue here.
It
would just be ridiculous, right? That the president is not subject to any statute unless Congress previously said, and by the way, this also applies to the president. I mean, that is so contrary to the idea, as you just said, that the president is above the law. Well, if I were writing this, the line, I would say one of them that was offered by Michael Dreeben, which is, did the person act as an office holder or as an office seeker? I think that would be a really clear way to draw the line here. What do you guys think about that? Or how would you draw the line between official act and unofficial act? Or would you draw the line at all? Let's just go around. Joyce, how would you draw
Yeah, I mean, this was something that I think highlights, by the way, the skill of Michael Dreeben, who argued for the special counsel's office. He immediately read the mood of the court, understood that they were stuck on this issue, and instead of insisting that they take his first choice view, he discussed this with them, I think, in a smart and an intelligent way. You know, I've always thought about the distinction as being official acts are President Trump and private acts are candidate Trump. That's the logical dividing line. But I heard the conservative justices and especially Justice Alito express some real concern here that personal acts would swamp private acts. And Dreeben pushed back very firmly, saying, you know, for one thing, there's no immunity right now. There's nothing to take away. If there is immunity, it will be because you have created it. And then he made a conversation happen about core presidential powers, Article II powers, and anything that flows from those powers would be official acts. But other things, you know, like sort of the stuff Trump was doing with his private lawyers, coming up with a private scheme to steal the election, that would clearly be personal. And so that feeds into the whole conversation about whether or not Jack Smith would have enough to go forward on if all he could prosecute were personal act or was personal activity. It looks like there is. I mean, it's not ideal. You don't want to give up anything, but he could do it, especially with this gloss Dreeben presented, which is that even if you can't prosecute on the basis of some official acts, you can still use those acts as evidence of Trump's state of mind. Yep. And that, Dreeben, I think, made the linchpin point here that might pull the court back from the brink of doom when he said, you know, listen, it's even worse that he was using his official powers. Even if we can't charge that, the fact that he abused the power of office to perpetrate this scheme is what you should really be worried about, court, not some theoretical rogue prosecutor that you think might show up in a future case.
Right. Where's that worry in every other case?
Yeah.
Kim, how would you decide this case?
I mean, just to play off of that, somehow 44 presidencies before Trump's were able to exist without this immunity that's so necessary to keep, you know, presidents from being chilled. None of them were chilled. They were fine. I would say that, you know, trying to overturn an election is not an official act.
Yeah. Jill, how about you? How would you decide this?
I don't think I would draw a line between them because I think no conduct of the president that constitutes a crime should be immune from prosecution. And I think to Kim's point, not only did 44 presidents before Trump and one since Trump, let's not forget that, survive without having immunity. And not only did I don't even know what number Nixon was, but Nixon knew there was no immunity. That's why he took a pardon. He wouldn't have accepted a pardon admitting his guilt if he thought he was immune from prosecution. And Ford, his successor, wouldn't have pardoned him if he didn't think he could be prosecuted. So I think this case is one that should be decided if everything at the Supreme Court were normal, that they would reject the total concept of criminal immunity.
All right. Well, if the four of us were on the court, we'd have this all settled. And also, interesting aside, Jill, interesting that you don't know what number Nixon was, but there's a reason for that. Until 41 and 43, we never talked about them in terms of numbers, I believe. And so, starting with 41,
so
to distinguish
Bush's fault,
George
right.
W. Bush's, we started talking about the numbers. And so now we know, like 44, 45, 43. So all of them before that kind of blend together.
Somehow,
I know the first. Yeah. I can tell you who the
somehow
first.
Somehow the Adamses were able to figure it out without numbers, but...
Yeah.
Well, as our listeners may know, for the last week, the trial of Donald Trump in New York has been rolling along. Recall that he is charged with falsifying business records in order to fraudulently kill unflattering stories before the 2016 election, afoul of campaign finance laws. And the key witness so far has been former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker. Joyce, I want to start with you. What is your take on Pecker, the fact that he's the first witness and the prosecution really told him to begin telling, chose him to begin telling this story about this so-called hush money scheme that ran afoul of criminal law, according to prosecutors? And do you think that he has been the star witness they wanted him to be?
You know, I think he was a strong kickoff witness, which is what you need. Prosecutors talk a lot about primacy and recency, the fact that juries remember best what they hear first and what they hear last. And so Pecker was very successful at telling the story of a scheme that wasn't just catch and kill. It was catch and kill to elect Trump. He held up well. I think people were a little bit surprised to learn that he had a deal with the government, that he actually was cooperating. Even though
I was surprised.
Yeah, I mean, that was a shocker. But he no animosity towards Trump, thought of him as a friend. I think that puts him in a very different place than Michael Cohen is in, obviously. And so you want a strong witness, a first witness who has an impact. Pecker was able to tell the story. Very importantly, he roped Trump into the center of the conspiracy. He began to provide some corroboration for the grilling of Michael Cohen that's yet to come. And he stood up well on cross-examination. You know, they tried to suggest that he had a faulty memory or that he had made some stuff up. When the prosecution came back for redirect, they went through it boom, 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 pointed out places where the defense had maybe disingenuously suggested that his recollection was flawed. And now they're off to the races on some smaller witnesses.
Yeah, I thought it was really important to have him because I think we've talked about this a little before. This case is a little complicated in that it alleges a crime on top of a crime to make it a felony, right? You have this falsification of a business record, but done for the criminal purpose of trying to keep unflattering information away from voters before an election. But I think he was able to put those two things together in saying that Trump was worried about the election and then talking about those business records, right? Who's paying him? You know, is it Cohen? Is it Trump? And then learning that, you know, this Trump is paying, but through Cohen, and sort of laying that nice baseline, which I thought might be helpful to a jury. Jill, what about Pecker's testimony stood out to you the most? And how good of a job do you think that Trump's defense attorneys did in trying to poke holes in Pecker's story?
Kim, I agree with Joyce that Pecker was a very good foundational witness. And I sort of see this as the prosecution building a house. And they built the framework. And you're right, they laid out two elements here, both business-wise and in terms of what was the motive. The motive, oh, gee, he never mentioned his family to me. He wasn't trying to protect them. Yes, we talked about the campaign and how it would affect the campaign. So I think the framework has been set, and there was some preemptive bolstering of future witness Michael Cohen, because he talked about things. And to the extent that he was cross-examined, for example, about, well, you told the federal government about this meeting and you didn't mention Hope Hicks was there. Well, when Hope Hicks testifies and says, I was there, big deal that he might have said something. And he handled it very well, saying, hey, these aren't my notes. I don't know who wrote them down, and they could be wrong. I remember exactly what I'm saying to you now, and I'm telling the truth now. So I think he did a good job. I think the cross-examination fell flat and maybe even hurt them. And I think the judge wasn't too happy with it either. So I think that so far the prosecution has scored a lot of points and the defense has not done so well.
Yeah, Barb, do you think that there were any drawbacks for the prosecution in calling Pecker first and in his testimony? I mean, listen, he works for the National Enquirer. We've all seen those magazines in the grocery store.
Love
checkout
them.
Lane. And but, you know, he was talking about catching and killing these stories and helping out his friend. I mean, could that be a drawback if the jurors just don't seem to like this guy?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting idea. You know, I do agree with Joyce that as a prosecutor, you always want to start strong with a witness that you think is going to hold up well in cross-examination. You don't want the whole thing to fall apart before it's barely started. And so I think he was strong. But I do agree with you that, like, everything he talked about is icky. And I think if I were a juror, I would find him, you know, kind of slimy. But that doesn't mean they don't believe him. And so I think he was an important witness because of his alliance with Donald Trump. You know, they're friends. And they still like each other. And it was important, I think, because not only was he an important witness, but you know, you can't always tell a story as a prosecutor chronologically, but I like it when you can, because you know, you can only go witness by witness. You don't really get to tell the whole story. But I think when you take witnesses out of order to achieve the primacy recency point that Joyce makes, I think it risks juror confusion. But here you've got somebody who was there at the inception in that August 2015 meeting when Trump decides he's going to run for president, and they come up with this plan like, oh, there's a lot of bad stuff out there. We are going to have to catch and kill that stuff. And then we're also going to put out some false stories about Trump's rivals. And we're also going to write some fawning things about Trump. This is all part of the same strategy. So I think it was good for that reason. But yeah, I didn't like him. I mean, he's talking about stuff that, you know, and I think by the time you get to this point as a prosecutor, you've talked to him so many times. Maybe you've become inured to the idea of what it is he's talking about. But for jurors, hearing about the idea that you're paying hush money and, like, you know, all of this sordid stuff, it came out about Arnold Schwarzenegger and Tiger Woods and Rahm Emanuel were also involved in some hush money payments. Like, that is not something normal people do. And so it sounds, I think, kind of sordid and seedy. So I think at the end of the day, the jury doesn't like him, but they believe him.
Hey, Barb, can I ask you a question, though?
Go ahead, Joyce.
My question, Barb, is this. Haven't you ever, I mean, I know you have. We've talked about it before, right? They have to do this with Cohen. I think that they do it with Pecker, too. They say, if you didn't like the subject matter of this case and the way these witnesses behaved, we didn't pick them. Donald Trump did. These were his friends, don't you think? Yeah, and then I don't care if the jury likes Pecker or not.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, absolutely. We didn't pick. Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. We, you know, I didn't pick this person. Donald Trump did by choosing to associate with him. Oh, yeah, I think that's right.
So I was going to say that, but I also want to say that reporting is that the jury is mesmerized by him and that they're taking a lot of notes and that they're really paying attention to him. So it's true. The prosecution didn't pick him. Donald Trump was in business with him. So the jurors have to be thinking, oh, this is the kind of person that he's friends with. This is a person who likes him. This is the person he does business with. I think that it will rebound against him as much as they will go, well, he's not so nice. And it is, I mean, the National Enquirer is a sleazy, slimy thing. On the other hand, he seemed credible. He seemed to hold up. He didn't get flustered. And so I think the jury is going to accept what he says. And what a sad world we're in, where a porn star and a sleazy publisher seem more credible mm-hmm. than the former president of the United States.
I did love the idea of the peek behind the curtain, and that perhaps does account for why the jury was so mesmerized by him. And I agree, that has been the reporting.
Yeah.
We have all been at the checkout line where we have seen those stories about, you know, Princess Di has space alien baby and all that. Like, who was writing this stuff? And he called it checkbook journalism. And so it was really interesting to get a peek behind the scenes that, you know, what we thought all along is true, which is none of this stuff is true whatsoever.
So aside from the trial, we also had some major news out of Arizona this week. A state criminal investigation into efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 election. A grand jury has charged 11 Arizona Republicans and 7 of Donald Trump's top aides in the scheme to use phony electors to certify the 2020 election. Though the names of the Trump aides are redacted, the details in the indictment make clear that we are talking about Rudy Giuliani, we're talking about John Eastman, we're talking about Mark Meadows, Jenna Ellis, and Christina Bob, Boris Epstein, and Michael Roman, people that we've all talked about on this podcast before. Joyce, I want to start with you. I want to get each of your reactions to these indictments and how they may play both in terms of the prosecutions against fake electors in places like Georgia and Michigan. What do you think, Joyce?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a righteous prosecution, right? This is the attorney general in Arizona saying, these people tried to steal the votes of Arizonans, and my obligation is to protect their rights. She gave what I thought was a surprisingly moving press conference from an attorney general. There appears to be little politics and only good prosecution in play in this case. And I talked with one of Barb's and my former colleagues in Arizona, you know, not knowing anything about the lawyers involved. And his reaction was, well, the lead prosecutor on this case is a solid kind of guy. You know that if he signed off on the prosecution, it'll be strong. The evidence will be there.
Jill, what do you think?
I think it's obviously a very good case. It's very interesting because of the 7 aides who are named. That makes it even more important. On the other hand, it's not surprising. I mean, other states, including Barb's home and yours, Michigan, have indicted other fake electors. So it is something that her predecessor, whose name is infamous because of the Brnovich case, refused to take any action, but she's doing the right thing. And I think she has done a good job. I thought her press conference was good and that this is going to be another successful prosecution.
Barb?
Yeah, I think there's value in having these cases going on in every state where there was an issue. There are other states as well. Wisconsin,
Pennsylvania,
Nevada, and Pennsylvania have yet to join the party. And, you know, these crimes were committed in all of these states. And so I think that the more of these prosecutions we see, the more pressure it puts on these defendants to seek some sort of global resolution and cooperate against everybody else. So I think all of these prosecutors are complementing the cause of justice.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
This week, we saw a second lively and sort of contentious argument in the Supreme Court. This one dealt with federalism and the power of the federal government to preempt state criminal laws, particularly about abortion. The district court and the Ninth Circuit barred the enforcement of Idaho's law that would have interfered with the delivery of emergency services in cases where a life or health of a pregnant person was involved. The Supreme Court allowed the enforcement pending the decision, which is not expected until this summer. And so it's really important because real life consequences are happening while the decision is pending. Women who are really challenged in a health way rather than a death way are being transferred out of state to have abortions to save their health. So Kim, let's just set the stage here. EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Labor Act, what's its purpose and how does it conflict with Arizona state law?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. Just as an aside, one of the shows that I watch for like total stress relief is called The Midwife, which I absolutely love. And I'm not up to current, but I'm up to where they're like in the 1950s. And I was watching an episode this week of a woman who had diabetes and she was pregnant. And, you know, the doctor was saying that she really needed to have a termination to save her health, but it was illegal. And I'm like, oh my God, this is supposed to be taking me off of what's going on in the world. And it's setting me right in where, you know, that's reality right now for people in America in 2024. But so EMTALA was passed in the 80s in the Reagan administration. And what it was meant to do was provide that any hospital that gets federal funding through Medicare must provide emergency care to anyone who shows up at an emergency room needing that care. Doesn't matter if they're not insured, doesn't matter what their race is, doesn't matter what their citizenship is, doesn't matter. You get federal funds, you treat people to stabilize them at the very least, to say if there is something that presents as a medical emergency, they need to at least be stabilized by care. You can't leave them out in the street. Well, what has been happening in Idaho, which has not the most restrictive abortion ban, but an abortion ban restrictive enough that some women who had some sort of complication that threatened their health, right? So that's the question here. How far can you go under this Idaho law to save the health of the mother when their health was threatened? Some of them were getting medvac'd out of the state, taking them to Salt Lake City and other places for emergency treatment, things like ectopic pregnancies, which at first was deemed to be covered by the Idaho's abortion ban. There was later a clarification, a ruling that it was an amendment to the law that you can now get emergency care for ectopic pregnancies, but it's uncertain. But this isn't just happening in Idaho. Places like North Carolina, in Texas, in Florida, where either doctors aren't sure about the law or the law is a ban, people have been giving birth in cars to babies outside of emergency rooms that later died. People have been miscarrying in emergency room lobbies. It's a really big problem. And the Biden administration is asserting, no, under EMTALA, if there's an emergency situation where care is needed, even if that care is abortion care, these hospitals that get federal funding must provide it regardless of what state law says, because federal law trumps.
So Joyce, the attorney arguing on behalf of the law for Idaho, argued that the language of EMTALA does not require doctors to provide abortions that violate state law. And he was asked about, are there examples of conflict between state criminal laws being preempted by federal law? And so I want to talk about, are there any other cases where federal law has preempted a state criminal law? And then I want you to go on with what the answers from our Solicitor General, the United States Solicitor General, Prelogar, how she answered and fought against this.
Yes. So listen, fun fact, Turner is not from Idaho, but Elizabeth Prelogar, the Solicitor General, is in fact an Idaho native. So she's arguing about something that she knows the details of. One of the big points here is that the Idaho law, in essence, changes the standard of care, which is supposed to be uniform across the country. So, you know, doctors don't know when a patient is about to die. That's not taught in law school. And that means they can no longer tell when they can perform an abortion. And that brings this law in direct conflict with EMTALA, which requires, as Kim laid out, that a patient be stabilized before they're, you know, forced to leave or transferred to another facility for care. And so that very clearly, in the view of the Solicitor General, has always created a conflict of law. But I think it's really important to acknowledge when this case was filed, the government understood that it was a real crapshoot with the Supreme Court, that there was a possibility that the court would not buy that, would not stick with Supremacy Clause law. As Barb says, they love to cherry pick their textualism. And so despite the fact that there's plainly a conflict, I think this is a risky case.
And Barb, I want to follow up on something Joyce just talked about, which is it's not clear when someone's about to die, but it is a lot clearer when their health is in jeopardy. So what did Idaho argue about whether the state would prosecute doctors who perform abortions under EMTALA? And is it enough to make a doctor feel comfortable to proceed if he, in his own reasonable judgment, feels it's necessary for the health of a patient?
Yeah, this is really where the crux of the issue is, I think, Jill. The statute, of course, in Idaho says abortions are permitted to save the life of the mother. And Joshua Turner even conceded that doctors could perform an abortion even if there was not medical certainty that a patient would die before they could perform an abortion without being criminally prosecuted. But then in questioning from Justice Jackson and Justice Kagan, they really pointed out the challenges that could happen if a person is in a state of, they refer to it as medical distress, that without an abortion, it could lead to the loss of organs, the loss of fertility, a need for lifelong treatment like dialysis or something else. And under those circumstances, he just said, yes, that would be a very difficult situation. He wouldn't really answer the question, which says, no, a doctor cannot be sure they would not be prosecuted under those circumstances and that this will have a chilling effect. And look, you know, if you're a doctor in Idaho and you want to perform good patient care, but you just cannot risk going to prison because some overzealous prosecutor in the state says that wasn't necessary to save the life of the mother and, you know, losing vital organs, that's not good enough. And you're prosecuted, you lose your license and you're going to prison. So it is going to have a chilling effect. And the way this line is drawn, I just for the life of me cannot understand why Idaho wants this to be the policy of their state.
Yeah, and this is definitely the real life consequences right now while the Supreme Court is allowing the enforcement of this. It's really, really bad for Idahoans. So, Kim, there was another interesting part of the argument that was brought up, which was the argument that the life of the unborn child must also be protected according to Alito. Is this a warning that fetal personhood is on the minds of the Supreme Court? And what would that mean?
These Alito questions. So I don't know who I...
We want you to channel him. Come on. What's he thinking?
Oh, we want to keep God. You out
so
on the ledge.
There is language.
Go on.
There is make language in EMTALA that refers to the unborn child. And Alito said incredulously, we have gone 90 minutes into this argument and nobody has mentioned unborn child. Well, what that means in EMTALA by any reasonable person who reads it means that if a woman presents in an emergency and say she is bleeding and her life may not be in immediate emergency danger, but she might be in danger of having a miscarriage if this bleeding can't be stopped or if she's injured or something and she doesn't get care, that EMTALA, yes, indeed covers emergency care to stabilize her so that she does not miscarry. That's what it means. Alito's trying to turn this around to make it seem like maybe EMTALA bars abortions. No, it does not. It really doesn't. It never has. That's just Alito seeing things through his crazy mirror. That's all I can say.
Okay, and Joyce, there's another issue, which is the Idaho Supreme Court narrowed the Idaho 6-week abortion ban. And so there was some argument that, well, there may not actually be a conflict between Idaho law and EMTALA anymore. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would stick to the same answer I gave you on the earlier conflict question. None of this changes the conflict between federal law, EMTALA, and the abortion ban. I mean, there's so much in this law that creates a supremacy clause problem that narrowing it in this way doesn't help, because you still have the issue about when can you provide an abortion? When is a woman's life at risk? There are even questions on the rape and incest questions, and it goes back to this issue of doctors lacking certainty that they can provide abortion without being prosecuted, which means no matter how they try to cure it, this law in Idaho remains fundamentally in conflict with federal law. So now we've reached our favorite part of the show, where we get to answer our listeners' questions. Boy, have y'all had a lot of questions this week. It has really, it's been quite a news week. If you've got questions for us, please email us at sistersinlaw@politicon.com or tag us at sistersinlaw.podcast on Threads or tweet using hashtag sistersinlaw. If we don't get to your question during the show, keep an eye on our Threads feed throughout the week, where we'll answer as many of your questions as we can. Our first question is from Kit in Nevada. And Kim, this one I think is just right for you. Who is involved in the process to file a brief? Who puts it all together and does final revising and editing? Are there group meetings to craft them? You've done a lot of work in private practice in this area. Tell us about briefing.
Yeah, and you've written your share of briefs too, Joyce. So generally speaking, there is an art to writing a brief. You want to be, as in my opinion, as brief, like literally as the,
tautological.
As the word says.
Very nice.
Tautological.
Nice use of that.
Exactly. There we go. And also persuasive as you can be, but do it in the shortest time possible. That's because you usually are working under strict time limits. You also don't want to run up a massive bill for your client. In fact, in the Trump case, I forget which, I don't know if it was for a brief or a motion, but in one of his cases, I believe it was the Chutkin case, attorney's fees were slashed because one of the attorneys had like logged 150 hours to write a brief or something. And the judge was like, that's ridiculous. No, you don't want to, time is money when you're writing a brief. So generally in my practice, what we did was I would write the brief primarily. Sometimes in larger practices than I had, you might also have law clerks who are doing things like researching cases and helping to supply some of that, the style, making sure the brief is in the right style. But generally, one person will write it and then they'll circulate it among other attorneys just to make sure that the arguments are right. In my law firm, we did appeals for cases that we tried. Often, appellate attorneys are completely different. So they have to spend some time with the record looking at the record and talking to the attorneys who tried the case below to sort of get an understanding of what the arguments are. And then you draft it, you make sure that it's in the right style. Back in my day, you had to get it like tabulated, like physically printed up. Like these days you have digital filing, which makes that a lot easier. But that, in a nutshell, it may differ according to the size of the firm or what public office or solicitor general's office that it's being done in. But generally speaking, that's the process of how it comes together.
It's such an important process. As lawyers, we take it for granted. And I love when our listeners send us these questions asking us to sort of demystify the process. So yeah. Thank you for that one. Next question from Sandra in East Brunswick, New Jersey. And she asks, would it be possible for witnesses in the election interference trial to say, I don't remember, when asked questions on the stand that could contradict Trump's denials? How do prosecutors get around this? Jill, do you want to take that one on?
I do. I love the question. And I love it especially because during Watergate, one of the allegations of the obstruction of justice was instructions to witnesses to say, I don't remember, I don't recall, even when they did. So if you are saying, I don't remember, I don't recall, when you do in fact, it's perjury. Now, how do you prove it's perjury? That's because you have a variety of techniques as a prosecutor or as a defense lawyer, if it happens in reverse, to prove that the person previously said something that showed that he did know, or because he told five other people that you call to the stand to prove that he did, or she did. And so I think prosecutors get it around it the same way they do about any other lie told by a witness. So it's wrong to say, I don't remember, unless you really don't remember. But if you don't remember, if you honestly don't, that is the honest answer, and you have to say that. And a lot of witnesses get themselves in trouble by trying to fill in the gap in their memory, and then they say the wrong thing. So that's bad too.
Barb, Judy in White Plains, New York asks, and this is such an important topic this week, something that's gotten lost in all of the Trump news. Can Harvey Weinstein be tried again after his New York conviction was overturned? Can you remind us who he is and talk about the conviction being reversed?
Yes. So when this news came out this week, I think that's what prompted Kim to text all of us, my head is exploding, right? Wasn't this the one? There's so much news coming. We're like, oh my gosh, what are we going to talk about this? So I'm glad we got this question. Harvey Weinstein, of course, is the big Hollywood mogul who was probably one of the biggest names to be taken down during the Me Too movement. He was prosecuted in California, and that conviction stands. He was also prosecuted in New York for sexually assaulting women, I think including Ashley Judd in the New York case. And his conviction was overturned not because of any finding about his guilt or innocence. That is completely undisturbed. But what they found, which happens sometimes on appeal, is that they believe that errors were made in his trial in that the judge allowed in evidence of other sexual assaults that were not part of the charged conduct. They have a name for it in New York under a case name, but in the federal system, we would call this a 404B evidence issue, where evidence of other bad acts is admissible, not to show a person's propensity to commit them, but to show what their MO is, you know, that they always do it this way. He always put on a white robe, and then he walked into the room, and then he dropped the robe, or whatever it is he did, that evidence can come in to show that this is this pattern and to prove his intent, absence of mistake, motive, and other things like that. So I suspect, as Alvin Bragg has said, they will try him again. And I think they will convict him again. It's just that this time around, they won't be able to bring in the evidence of those things that the appeals court said it was erroneous to bring in. You know, this is kind of a discretionary standard. The Court of Appeals thought the trial judge abused his discretion in allowing it in. The standard is whether something is substantially more prejudicial than it is probative. And so it's a bit of a judgment call. The judge at trial let it in. On appeal, they said no. So I suspect they'll try it again. And I fully expect that he'll be convicted again.
And remember, he's also convicted in California.
Right, so which
he's
stands.
And they're going to transfer him from New York.
I was so happy to see that.
They're going to transfer him from his jail, his prison in New York, to a prison in California, because that is where he is still convicted. But I just want to add one quick reference to the fact that there is evidence of other bad acts that Judge Merchan said could come in the New York case. If Donald Trump testifies to
against Donald impeach, Trump.
Yes, against Donald Trump, to impeach his credibility as a witness.
Thank you for listening to Hashtag Sisters-in-Law with Jill Winebanks, Kimberly Atkins-Store, Barb McQuaid, and me, Joyce Vance. Our live shows are almost here and we cannot wait. May 2nd in Chicago, May 9 in Detroit, May 30 in Boston. Everyone should go to politicon.com/tour now to get tickets, even if you don't live in one of those cities. Take a road trip with your friends. And please show some love to this week's sponsors, Calm, Thrive Cosmetics, Framebridge, and Lomi. You can find their links in the show notes. Please support them because they really do make this podcast possible. Please follow Hashtag Sisters-in-Law on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please give us a 5-star review. It really does help others find the show. See you next week with a new episode, a live episode. Hashtag Sisters-in-Law.
guys, when we get to Chicago on our live tour, like, can I not get the worst dressing room this time?
Dressing room? I mean, you got honestly, a dressing room? I didn't get a dressing room.
Oh, you didn't know that?
Dressing room?
Okay, never mind.
They told me,
I don't think any of us knew about the dressing
stage
room.
Stage ready. Dressing room.
You didn't have the bowl of just green M&Ms?
Or the white shag carpeting?
Oh,
I'm volunteering to do your hair and makeup, Kim, so that you can be the best look that you ever were.
Ah, I love you. I could use the help. Thank you, Jill.